On the show today, Sweden moves closer to joining NATO.
I'm glad to announce that as a result, President Erdogan has agreed to forward the accession protocol for Sweden to the Grand National Assembly as soon as possible.
Plus, a power struggle in the Palestinian territories.
There are no tangible results from a Mordabun peace process, while many reject the aging and ineffective leadership in the Palestinian Authority.
And later, North Korea claims the U.S. violated its airspace, and Nigeria's president is set to take on some new responsibilities. We get the latest from Abuja. Today is Tuesday, July 11th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. Ukraine's goal of joining NATO will need to wait. That story in a moment. Now, however, it's Sweden's turn. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has agreed to forward Sweden's bid to join the NATO military alliance to its parliament. That's the final hurdle for Sweden to join the alliance. Here's NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg on the eve of the NATO summit in Vilnius.
I have just had a constructive meeting with President Erdogan and Prime Minister Kristersson. I'm glad to announce that as a result, President Erdogan has agreed to forward the accession protocol for Sweden to the Grand National Assembly as soon as possible and work closely with the Assembly to ensure ratification.
Stoltenberg declined to give a date for when Sweden's accession would be ratified by the Grand National Assembly, the Turkish parliament, which would have to decide on the exact timing. And at the NATO summit in Vilnius this week, a major question will be whether Ukraine should also be able to join the alliance. And even though there won't be a vote on the issue, the U.S. and Germany worry that it could lead NATO into direct confrontation with Russia. VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gungadze reports.
With the annual NATO summit set to start Tuesday in Vilnius, Lithuania, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky last week visited member states and signed bilateral agreements supporting Ukraine's bid to join the alliance, even though no vote on its candidacy is planned. At the stop in the Czech Republic, he addressed the membership issue. He said that some nations are still looking at Moscow and are afraid of it. The Ukrainian leader challenged those nations, saying that it is the moment to demonstrate the bravery and unity of the alliance, and that Ukraine wants to see clear signals and concrete steps toward membership. Lithuania's former defense minister, Rasa Juknevasin, a member of the European Parliament, says NATO's members in Eastern Europe are its biggest proponents.
Baltic states, Poland, Czech Republic, I would say the whole Eastern part, those who joined NATO and understand and enjoy what they got from that membership.
In contrast to many NATO member states, the U.S. and Germany think Ukraine isn't ready yet politically or militarily and are worried that welcoming Ukraine could eventually drag the alliance into a direct conflict with Russia. Before departing to Europe this week, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Ukraine still need to lay some groundwork before it can join NATO.
Vilnius will be an important moment on that pathway towards membership because the United States, our NATO allies in Ukraine, will have the opportunity to discuss the reforms that are still necessary for NATO for Ukraine to come up to NATO standards.
NATO has said it is ready to support Ukraine's reforms to its security and defense systems. Former Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk argues that Ukraine is ready for membership and that it will benefit NATO.
Ukraine practically demilitarized Russian military, conventional troops. So it's going to take another decade for Russia just to revamp, restore, and rebuild its conventional forces in Europe. So the skills, the experience, and the combat experience that that Ukrainian military has is just unbelievable. So that's definitely in the interest of the NATO member states to have Ukraine in.
Polls show that more than 80% of Ukrainians want their country to join NATO. Yatsenyuk says their expectations of the NATO Vilnius summit are clear.
The Ukrainian people expect that during the Vilnius summit, Ukraine at least is to get an invitation to join NATO. I am quite realistic, and I do believe that our NATO members and our NATO partners, they will find the political will not just to issue another declaration with the vague and ambiguous definitions, that the door is open.
The two-day NATO summit could be either a historic moment for NATO or perhaps a missed opportunity. Some analysts say the alliance will find a middle ground solution. Miroslava Gungadze, UA News.
Analysts say Israel's biggest military raid on Jenin in 20 years marks a new, more violent era in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Disaffected Palestinian youths affiliated with militant groups now rival a weak Palestinian political leadership, and they're seeing violence as the only way to resolve the long simmering conflict. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
The United Arab Emirates has promised $15 million in aid to support United Nations relief operations in Jenin after deadly violence turned the refugee camp's streets and houses into rubble and cut off power and water. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged Israel to abide by its international legal obligations, saying that escalation is not the solution, warning that violence simply bolsters radicalization. Israel maintains that it was uprooting radical militants and weapons caches in the West Bank camp. Observers like Jordanian independent analyst Osama El-Sharif see Israel's military incursion as encouraging more Palestinian youth to join militant groups. That's because, he told VOA, there are no tangible results from a Mordabun peace process, while many reject the aging and ineffective leadership in the Palestinian Authority.
It's a generation in despair. There hasn't been any kind of genuine attempt to create hope for the majority of Palestinians in the occupied territories. This Palestinian Authority is incapable of protecting the Palestinians in the areas that it controls. The only thing that the Israelis want from the Palestinian Authority is security coordination. They are not talking to the PA over a peace process. They are not in favor of an independent Palestinian state. They are against the two-state solution. So what else is there for especially those young Palestinians increasingly seeing what is left of the West Bank being colonized by Jewish settlers?
Washington Post columnist David Ignatius blames both Israel and the Palestinians for the worrying developments. The Palestinian Authority security forces, he said, have lacked the firepower or the will to challenge the growing presence of Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Jenin, both militant groups backed by Iran. Others, like the Jenin Brigades, have risen to confront violence by Jewish settlers. The group reported that 8 out of the 12 dead were its members, while hundreds of others were wounded. Ignatius also criticizes Israel's refusal to control and discipline the ever-expanding Jewish settlements in the West Bank, undertaken by its current hardline nationalist government, pointing out that even if both sides really wanted a Palestinian state to materialize now, there is simply not enough land left in the small territory dotted with Israeli settlements and outposts. Michael Milstein, a former advisor to the Israeli agency overseeing Palestinian affairs in the West Bank, told London's Financial Times that Jenin is a wake-up call. The basic problems in the West Bank are much deeper than terror or military or security problems. You also need to take care of political and social and economic problems, Milstein said, pointing to the apparent disintegration of the Palestinian Authority. Jordanian analyst El-Sharif said there doesn't appear to be an end game.
We're reaching the point of truth when you talk about a second or a third intifada, an implosion. All negative scenarios are there waiting to happen because simply there is no alternative, no political process.
He said that inside Israel, there also seems to be no answer to what is next. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. Authorities in Lianjiang in southern China said Monday that a man killed 6 people and wounded a 7th at a kindergarten. Local media reports say the dead include 3 children, 2 parents, and a teacher, and that a knife was used in the attacks. The Netherlands and Indonesia on Monday praised the return of hundreds of cultural artifacts, including valuable jewels and 13th century temple carvings that were taken, sometimes by force, during colonial times. The move is seen as a major step forward in restitution efforts worldwide. An Iranian rapper who was arrested during last year's nationwide protests has been sentenced to 6 years and 3 months in prison. And on Monday, 10 people were injured, 6 of whom were hospitalized, in the dangerous and famous Running of the Bulls in Pamplona, Spain. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Early results of an ongoing study show that a type of bacteria that lives within the human microbiome may lead to developing type 2 diabetes, while another microbe may prevent the illness. Researchers at the Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles have found that people who have a higher level of a bacterium called flavonefractor are more inclined to have lower insulin sensitivity, which means the body's cells can't efficiently use the hormone insulin to control their blood sugar. On the other hand, the researchers discovered that those with a higher amount of a bacterium called Coprococcus tend to have higher insulin sensitivity, meaning they can more effectively use insulin to reduce their blood sugar. The microbiome is a diverse community of trillions of microorganisms that live inside of our bodies. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. The Nigerian president takes on some more responsibilities. We'll find out what in a few minutes. Now to North Korea, where the government there has accused the United States of violating its airspace with spy planes. Joel Flynn of Reuters has the story.
North Korea has accused the United States of flying spy planes over the country and threatened to shoot them down. That's according to a statement carried by the official KCNA news agency website on Monday, which quoted North Korea's Ministry of National Defense. The statement said that a plane flew into North Korean airspace, quote, dozens of kilometers over its East Sea several times, adding, quote, there is no guarantee that such a shocking accident as the downing of the U.S. Air Force strategic reconnaissance plane will not happen. South Korea's military said North Korea's claim of airspace violation was false.
U.S. air surveillance assets conduct routine reconnaissance flights around the Korean Peninsula, and North Korea's claim of airspace violation is not true. We strongly urge the North to immediately stop creating tension with these false claims.
The North Korean statement said the provocative military actions by the U.S. were bringing the Korean Peninsula closer to a nuclear conflict. Last month, an American nuclear-powered cruise missile submarine made a port call at Busan in South Korea. That came amid air and navy drills being conducted by U.S. and South Korean forces, also involving a U.S. aircraft carrier and heavy bombers. Less than 2 weeks ago, North Korea held mass rallies in Pyongyang showing posters with missiles hitting the United States. Those marked the 73rd anniversary of the start of the Korean War. State-run television KRT said people were heard shouting slogans, vowing a, quote, war of revenge. The rallies were held amid concerns Pyongyang could soon conduct another launch of its first military spy satellite to boost monitoring of U.S. military activities. That's after its first attempt ended in failure at the end of May.
That's Reuters' Joel Flynn. Now, fighting may have stopped in Ethiopia's Tigray region, but the people's suffering has not. Supplies of food aid have been disrupted amid a dispute between Ethiopia's main donors and the government. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
Curled up on a bed, Tsege Shishai struggles to breathe. The 10-year-old weighs just 22 pounds. Her doctor says she's dying. The guns may have fallen silent in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region, but the suffering has not ended. An acute food shortage now grips a population already hit by 2 years of war and struggling with drought. Tsege's father, Asmalash Shishai, says her body is so damaged by malnutrition that she is unable to eat.
Initially, we were trying to give her soup mixed with milk, but unfortunately, she doesn't take food now. This is all because we didn't have any food in the beginning.
Food deliveries had resumed to Tigray after a ceasefire deal in November, but they have again been disrupted. The UN's World Food Programme and the US Agency for International Development have temporarily suspended food aid, alleging it was being diverted away from those in need. Ethiopia's government has said it is investigating, but criticised the suspension. An Ethiopian government spokesperson did not respond to a request for comment. Gebrehiwot Gebregziab here is head of the Tigray Region Disaster Risk Management Commission. He said that 595 people had died from the direct or indirect effects of hunger in several areas of Tigray. The president of the Tigray Interim Administration, Getachew Reda, has said on Twitter that he had held talks with WFP officials about efforts to resume aid flows. Both the WFP and USAID said they are working to ensure aid reaches the intended recipients and aim to restart deliveries as soon as possible. WFP Senior Regional Communications Officer for Eastern Africa, Brenda Kariuki.
We are currently on track to resume food distributions in July, starting in the Tigray region. We are also implementing a new targeting methodology to identify the most vulnerable in the communities and rolling out a new digital registration system so that WFP can better identify and verify beneficiaries to ensure that the right people are receiving critical food at the right time.
According to the WFP, around a fifth of Tigray's 6 million population was severely food insecure in February. People like farmer Walde Selassie Gebremedin and his three children are struggling to survive. They live at a school in Abiadi, a town hosting 51,000 people displaced by fighting. An official at the makeshift camp said 118 people there were in a critical condition due to malnutrition. Walde Selassie says his wife has already died of hunger. My wish and my prayer, he says, is to not see my children dying before me.
David Doyle of Reuters reporting for us today. And finally, Nigerian President Bola Tinubu has been named to lead the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. Tinubu said he would be focusing on fighting growing insecurity and terrorism in West Africa and promoting democracy among member states after a series of military coups. Timothy Obezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
The ECOWAS Heads of State meeting held in Guinea-Bissau was Bola Tinubu's first engagement with counterparts in the region since he became Nigeria's president in May. West African leaders chose Tinubu as the regional bloc's chair for the next year, taking over from Guinea-Bissau's Umaro Sissoko Embalo. Senator Iribu, the founder of security magazine The Global Sentinel, says Tinubu's selection was not a surprise.
It's a good move because of the stature and role of Nigeria in the sub-region. By financial commitment, Nigeria provides almost or more than 60% of the financial burden of ECOWAS. So it will help to strengthen the stand of the organization and the sub-region, and Nigeria has played a significant role in keeping the peace in the region and stability.
However, Iribu says Tinubu's appointment as ECOWAS chief may be poorly timed as the new president's political opponents in Nigeria are still challenging his election victory in court.
People have expected, okay, they should wait for the conclusion of electoral petition tribunal election. Yes, by law, he's the president has been sworn in, but the legitimacy or the victory is still being challenged. These are kind of things that give room to instability because of disaffection. We know what happened in Guinea.
The Guinean military overthrew President Alpha Conde in September 2021, a year after opponents rejected his re-election. Mali and Burkina Faso have also seen military coups in the last 3 years. In his remarks Sunday, Tinubu pledged to prioritize democratic stability, saying, quote, "We will not accept coup after coup in West Africa again," end quote. Tinubu said the threat to peace and security in the region has reached an alarming level and called for joint regional counterterrorism measures. In Nigeria, 36 villagers were killed by gunmen Sunday in the north-central Benue and Plateau states. Tinubu also called for more private sector participation in order to unlock West Africa's economic potential. But economist at the Center for Social Justice, Eze Onyebere, says Nigeria needs to overhaul its own economy to benefit from the ECOWAS Pact.
Nigeria has a strategic position in the region, but whatever you do in terms of political or economic or social diplomacy is a product of your home front, your economy, your politics. So if the Nigerian economy is properly repositioned to become more productive, the ECOWAS market is ours for the taking. I mean, nobody should compete with us. But as of today, with all the challenges we have and the potential ones that are coming, it's going to be very difficult for Nigeria to take advantage of all these opportunities.
Tinubu said Nigeria will host an ECOWAS summit on trade and investment in October as part of his vision for regional economic recovery. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken's visit to Beijing in June and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's July visit testify to the importance of managing the great power relationship between the United States and the PRC. Secretary Blinken said the United States and the PRC have competing visions for the future, one that upholds a free and prosperous world order based on international norms and rights, and one that promotes an illiberal order that devalues human rights, exercises predatory economic practices, and claims spheres of influence. We want to make sure in that competition, said Secretary Blinken, our vision prevails. In the meantime, the two nations must strive for peaceful coexistence because neither country is going away. Secretary Blinken acknowledged that Beijing's aggression toward Taiwan is a threat to peaceful coexistence and to the agreed-upon status quo.
But if you go back to 2016, we've seen Beijing taking actions that suggests that the status quo was not acceptable. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that in some of the military operations that they've been engaged in. We've seen that in the economic coercion exerted against Taiwan, and for that matter, exerted against countries that have relationships with Taiwan.
Secretary Blinken rejected the PRC's contention that Taiwan is solely a sovereign issue of China's.
50% of commercial traffic, trade, goes through that strait every single day. 50% of the container traffic in the world. 70% of the semiconductors that we use from everything from our smartphones to our washing machines to our automobiles made on Taiwan. If there were to be a crisis as a result of actions that either side takes, you've got potentially a global economic crisis.
Because of that, Secretary Blinken said, country after country is going to both of us and saying, we expect the responsible management of this issue to be sustained. Secretary Blinken emphasized that the One China policy of the United States has not changed. He also said, we are there for Taiwan.
Under the Taiwan Relations Act, we've had a longstanding policy of making sure that we could do what's necessary to help Taiwan defend itself.
Secretary Blinken said it is essential that the competition between the United States and the PRC not veer into conflict and that lines of communications are built back up. And I think, he declared, you're going to start to see more engagement in both directions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.